Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
And welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40. Created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster, Sam Baker. It's the final episode of the season and all my podcasting dreams have come true because my guest this week, by popular demand and a whole ton of begging, is the one, the only, the legend that is Miriam Margolyes. Miriam started her career in theatre and radio, voiced some of the best known ads of the late 20th century. And I'm not going to try and do the Cadbury's Caramel Bunny because I just can't out Miriam. Miriam won a BAFTA for her role in Martin Scorsese's Age of Innocence and millions of tiny hearts as Professor Sprout in Harry Potter. At 82, she is busier than ever, a Vogue cover star, one of TV's best-loved documentary makers. And if you haven't seen her in a camper van with Alan Cumming going around Scotland, you absolutely must try and catch up. And she's the best-selling author of 2 memoirs, This Much Is True and Oh, Miriam. Can you tell I was just a little bit excited? I could hardly contain myself on the train.
One of the lovely things about keeping working is that I am meeting new people, and obviously many of them are much younger than myself. And that is a pleasure.
I met Miriam in Glasgow ahead of her live show to talk about everything from having her womb out in her mid-30s, and she only went to the doctor for a sore nose, wearing trainers to Buckingham Palace before that was a thing, and why she's really, really bored of being labelled just a lesbian. We also discussed never wanting children, her 54-year love match, and the power of living a life with no secrets. Miriam, thank you so much for coming on The Shift and fitting me in on your hectic schedule. Vogue cover star at 82.
Absurd.
How'd you pull that off?
Well, I was totally amazed. I got the email from my agent. I thought it was a hoax, and it turned out not to be. And so, of course, I said yes, because I was thrilled to bits. Gay pride is something I've joined in on from time to time, but I'm getting bored in a way with being just being labelled as a lesbian, because I'm hopefully a human being. So lesbian is an adjective, it's not a noun in my book. But to be a cover girl, I mean, it was amazing, really amazing.
And Tim Walker, who's an amazing photographer.
Oh, he's brilliant.
Fantastic.
Gosh, and I have to say, we've become friends. I mean, after all, if you strip in front of someone you don't know, you kind of get through all the preliminaries fairly quickly.
Intimacy.
Yeah. So that was lovely. And I'm terribly grateful to him. And it's been good for Vogue, I think, because they sold a lot more copies than they usually do. And I got, I don't know what you call it, I got sort of smug. I thought to myself, I'm a Vogue cover girl. And I think there are very few people who can say that.
Yeah, not many people can say that. What do you think? It's, I can't remember. I've been reading both of your books this week and I can't remember which one it's in. But you've said that your mother despaired of your style. What do you think she would have made of it?
I think she would have been very pleased with the clothes. And it took 20 people to make me look like that. You know, they came in the morning at about 7:30. And there was an army of shoes and scarves and fascinators and all kinds of things came in. And a nailist who did my nails and a hair lady and a makeup, a stylist. I actually had who I've definitely become friends with because I need her.
That wasn't the first time in your career, was it, that you'd had that, all that attention?
Oh, yes, it was. I've never had a whole army of people trying to make me look reasonable. It was amazing. And I have to say that I didn't know anything about the fashion world and didn't really respect it very much. I felt it wasn't for people like me and I didn't care about it. But when I met the people who actually worked in it, I could see that they were immensely skilled and dedicated. And my respect for that world that I so seldom tiptoe into has gone up without question. I only knew one person in it who was Susie Menkes, who was at school with me, at Cambridge with me, at the university at Newnham. And she didn't like me and I didn't like her. So I thought I didn't know much about the fashion business at all. However, my mother did have a dress shop and had a very big sense of style. For example, she always wore a cape, not a coat. And I found it, as you do when you're young and mummy comes to school and she doesn't look like anybody else's
mummy. Oh, yeah, you just want to dress like the others.
Exactly. And I used to say, mummy, don't wear the cape, don't wear the cape. But now I'm proud of her and I wish I'd had that flair that she had, but I just don't.
It's like it's nice if you care and if you don't care, then
well, you just do. You try to be true to yourself. I'll never be a fashion plate. I'm the wrong shape, the wrong height, and I don't care enough. But I was terribly chuffed, I would say. Chuffed to buggery I was.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe not something you thought you'd ever see on your CV.
Well, of course not. Nobody else thought I would either.
Is it fair to say you're the busiest you've ever been?
It is fair to say that. And it feels bewildering when I think about it. I don't know why I've relatively recently become terribly ubiquitous on everybody's television, because I'm not on social media except for Facebook. I don't belong to Twitter or Instagram. I don't know any of the other ones, but you know, whatever the other ones are, I'm not on them. I think it was Graham Norton, the Graham Norton show, that which was really, honestly, it was about 12 years ago, maybe more, when I first went on. And I think that's what made the difference.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because it's not like you hadn't done so much before.
Well, I kept employed for a long time. I mean, I wasn't a star, and I never have been a star. But I've been, you know, a jobbing actor for quite a long time. And I'm very proud that I didn't have to go and do something else, as many, many people do. And I don't think it's because of my talent. I believe I'm talented, and I believe that a lot of that talent is still untapped, that I have reserves of brilliance that have not been explored. However, I'm useful, I'm versatile, and I'm pleasant, and I think people like to have somebody who's cheery around the place, because life is very frightening and tight and hard sometimes. So I think it's my personality as much as anything else which has made me constantly employed.
You said, I've been an outspoken old lady since I was a little girl. Do you think that's why?
I can't explain it. I don't know if it's because I was an outspoken, but I've always been an outspoken person. I always was, even when I was at school. And before, I remember saying at a gathering once at home, that man walks like a lady.
Yeah. How old were you then?
I suppose I was about 10. Yeah. You know, but I was sharp enough to see that he was a bit of a... What did Mummy call it? A bit of a Nancy boy. Well, yeah. Things... yes, it's lovely. Look, I'm not knocking it. I'm just hoping that I'm strong enough and keep well enough to deliver good performances and entertain people. That's what you always hope for and worry about.
Yeah. How are you doing? How's your...
Well, I've got lots of things wrong with me. I've got a cow's heart. On May the 5th, I had a very interesting operation procedure, cardiac procedure called a TAVI, which is I had my own faulty aortic valve, which is the biggest one in the heart, replaced by a cow's.
Wow.
And they do two little incisions in your groin. It's not open heart surgery, but it would have been years ago, but they have this new procedure now. I did it privately, which is something that always makes me nervous because I so believe in the National Health Service. But I always say it, I have to admit it, because yeah. I don't want somebody to say, oh, you're always talking about the National Health Service. You had a private thing.
Yeah, yes, you jumped the queue.
Yeah, I did. A, because I could afford it, and B, I knew that if I didn't have it when I had time to have it, this whole book and tour and everything would have had to be scrapped. And I had another film in Australia to do, a documentary. So a lot of people's careers, not careers, that's not fair, but, you know, money, income, yeah, would have depended on my being fit enough to carry it out. So I thought, well, you know, do it. So I did it. And it was scary, and I was a bit peculiar afterwards, and I may still be, but it was okay.
Has it helped?
I think it has. I think, I mean, it made me feel terribly vulnerable because heart problems were in my family on my mother's side, and I knew that could have not ended well. I've also got osteoporosis and spondylolisthesis and osteoarthritis, and I've got a weak bladder. And
haven't we all?
I know it's really nuisance that I always have to check where the loo is. In fact, I haven't checked where the loo is on this floor where we're talking.
Elliot, where's the loo?
That isn't that lucky.
That's good to know.
It's good to know
for both of us.
So I'm aware of my body wearing out. And also, to some extent, I'm not as sharp as I used to be mentally. I'm still here. So thank God, thank you, whoever's responsible.
Still working like crazy. What are the good... That's obviously the duff side of ageing. What have you liked about getting older?
I've liked that people know who I am now quite often. Not always. They don't always spell my name right still. That's always a source of real rage.
I like they pronounce it?
Well, no, they never pronounce it correctly. It's always Margoyles or Margolis. I remember my father's partner, that is his locum, you know, medical partner, was very drunk. This is before I was born. And Mummy told me one day he sort of reeled into the surgery and said, oh, good morning, Mrs. Garmolias. So, Garmolias, they're not been called yet. But anyway, it's not an easy name to pronounce. As you get older, people listen to what you say, because you can say, listen, I know that if you eat too much after 7 o'clock, you're not going to have a good night's sleep. So you can dispense advice and people may or may not listen to it because you're older. But there's not very much to be said about good about getting old. I think it's a, you know, it's a bit of a mug's game. The only thing is, that what's the alternative?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what's good.
We're still here.
Have you found that you care less about all those kind of stupid, well, not stupid, they don't seem stupid at the time, but the things that you one wastes energy on?
Well, you know, I have to say, no, I care more. I actually care more about things now. I won't let the least grammatical mistake go by. I won't I point out people's mistakes in the rudest way. I think I've become I don't know what to say. I don't think I'm deliberately, but I think I'm tiresome quite often. Yeah, I do. I do care more because there's so little time left to get it right.
Cast your mind back. How old do you think you were when you started to get really comfortable in your skin, when you reached that point where you were like, this is who I am. I'm not going to pretend to be other than I am. This is who I am.
I don't know that I feel that now. It depends on the day or the person that needs to be impressed. Sometimes, well, you know, one thing I decided, I don't know when, about maybe 15 years ago, I'm not wearing high heels. I'm not going to push my feet into difficult shoes.
God, you lasted pretty well if that was only 15 years ago.
Well, I probably didn't wear high heels, but people said to me, you know, when I have to go to receptions or first nights or something, I mean, I don't do them anymore, but if I had to, people would say, well, oh, the dress is lovely. What about shoes, Miriam? I say, well, fuck the shoes.
Yeah.
You know, I wear trainers and I've worn them at Buckingham Palace and Hyde Park and anywhere else I'm going. I want to be comfy. Probably I've always wanted to be comfortable, but sometimes I've had to wear smart shoes and now I don't bother. I just think, well, tough titty. They'll take me as I am. And I try to get people to concentrate on this half, you know, just sort of above the nipples.
Yeah.
Because I'm quite happy with above the nipples. Below the nipples, not so sure.
Have you always felt like that? Is that newish?
Life is a process, isn't it? And it's a process that you largely conduct unconsciously. I'm not really conscious of suddenly thinking, oh my goodness, this is new. The only thing that I have noticed is when my knees started to hurt, I thought, oh, that's new. And then quite recently, my hands have got a bit more arthritic-y. And I do notice that. And that's only within the last, I don't know, 6 months. But on the whole, I've not been self-critical enough in any way. I just continue, and so it goes. I don't think any single thing has sharpened my awareness to my condition or my character or my change in character. Most of the people that I met on the tour that I knew at school have said I'm completely unchanged.
That's interesting. You have got a remarkable capacity to make and keep friends, haven't you?
I hope so.
I really have. When I was reading the books, I was just thinking, oh my God, this is just like everywhere you go, you collect another friend and another friend and another friend, and you're still in touch with them all.
It's exhausting sometimes because I want people to know that I care about them. Sometimes it's difficult because there are so many and I don't have that much time. But one of the lovely things about keeping working is that I am meeting new people, and obviously many of them are much younger than myself. And that is a pleasure. And I get to know young people. And I don't know what they think. I don't want them to think that I'm marvellous because I know I'm not. But they give me confidence and they laugh at my jokes. And that's very rewarding.
Has it changed your attitude a bit? Because so many people as they get older, they get more insular, don't they? And so much is made of kind of generational divide. And has spending, you know, encountering younger people, much younger or a bit younger, has that changed your approach?
I'm grateful that I'm able to meet young people, because I think to be in a world entirely of your own generation would not increase your knowledge and increase your awareness of the world around you. I wish they read more. I'm quite critical of young people. But on the other hand, when I see them interacting, I think how brilliantly free they are. I once saw a group of young people having a picnic lunch, and they were all tumbled on top of each other, and not sexually particularly. It wasn't like that. It was just a relaxed pleasure in being together with friends. But when I was young, I was always worrying, does my breath smell? Is my period showing? Are my armpits too hairy? Or, I was worried socially. And I don't think young people are so worried about things like that. They may be, but it doesn't seem so to me on the surface. So I'm happy to know young people and to learn from them. But they've got to learn from me about words and apostrophes and how to read and how to be critical of stuff they read. But I always used to say I don't like young people. Well, that's not true. I do like young people, but I'm not sure I can deal with children. Children are a little bit too much for me.
Has that always been the case?
Yes, from the beginning.
So there's no way in which you would ever have fancied having one?
Never. Which is lucky, because I had my womb out in 1974, and it didn't bother me. You know, it didn't bother me in the sense that, oh, my God, I'm not going to have children. I didn't worry about that. I just thought I want to survive.
Yeah. You were about 34?
34, yeah.
34. What was that? Was that fibroids?
It was fibroids. It was benign fibroids. And, you know, the doctor found them, and he was very uncaring, really. He said, oh, come and have a look at this, nurse, you know. They were both peering up my jacksie and sort of talking about, my goodness, I haven't seen one as big as that for years. Okay. And you think, look, I'm here at the other end of this. But anyway, I had it out, and I'm glad I did, actually.
So did you then have a really early, you know, really premature menopause?
No, I didn't have a menopause at all. I mean, I've never been aware of a menopause. I've never noticed that I had. I just stopped having periods. And with the end of periods came a kind of remarkable peace, and meant I had another 6 days every month to myself without bothering about all that sanitary towel or Tampax or, God, I've run out of this and that, you know. No, I emerged into a menopauseless world with pleasant alacrity.
Yeah, nice work. I mean, also, if you'd had a whopping great fibroid like that, you must have been having the periods from hell.
No, they weren't. They really weren't. Otherwise, but I would have gone to the doctor about that. But in fact, I went to the doctor because I had fallen and hurt my nose.
And what was he doing down
well,
there?
Well, he just said, shall I give you a general examination or something, you know? So I said, oh, yeah, might as well. So we did. But, I mean, in fact, it wasn't for that I went to see him.
So you went in for... And you know,
if I hadn't fallen,
the hysterectomy.
If I hadn't fallen, I'd probably still have had a womb.
Oh, God. That's crazy.
It is. It was extraordinary.
You were really, really close to your mum, weren't you?
Yes.
Growing up.
I adored her. I still adore her. She's still someone I love to talk about and think about and remember. She was a complicated woman. She had quite big mood swings. Somehow she was totally capable. Mummy could do anything except sew. She couldn't sew. So we had Miss Norridge, who was our dressmaker, but who was lovely. I remember Miss Norridge. She had one of those kind of big hairdos, a sort of wedge on one side and a wedge on the other. Very strange.
A great kind of a flicky roll thing.
Yeah. But Mummy was all-powerful in our family.
You write really movingly about the kind of conversations that you had with her when you were really little. Do you think that that prompted in you a kind of curiosity for other people?
I don't know if it prompted the curiosity that I genuinely do have about other people. Mummy was the first person with whom I told everything, and she told me everything. So I was always expecting that kind of intimacy with everybody I met. And of course, you don't get that. Some of my friends, I remember one particular in Newnham, college, who said, "Miriam, you're not giving me any space." I thought, I think I say this in my books, I thought it meant I was standing too close to her. Mm-hmm. I didn't realise that people had to have emotional space. I never allow that. it's still a kind of pushy habit. But Mummy was a very successful mother, and she was a very successful human being, I think. And she was my model. I probably inculcated from her how to react and interact with other people. So for me, she has been a continual inspiration. Every time I meet a new person, the techniques that Mummy evoked in me will be set to another human being. And it hasn't failed.
You're just saying that she told you everything and you told her everything. Were there sometimes things she told you that you'd rather she hadn't?
Well, I remember when she once told me, you know, "Daddy and I made love last night." And I remember feeling a bit, you know, should I know that? Because children are very prudish.
And, yes, you know, very, especially where their parents are concerned.
Of course. So I thought, I can remember that. I can remember feeling that. So, yes, that sort of thing. But nothing else. I loved her stories of her youth. And it was interesting because I found out, because I loved doing genealogy, that her grandfather had been in prison. And I do not know if she ever knew that. I suspect she didn't, because I think she would have talked about it. But he was sent to prison long before she was born, in 1877, and Mummy was born in 1905. I don't think she knew that. I think that was kept from her because it was shameful. I think from my discovery of that, and then lots of other discoveries about my family, have enhanced my longing to ask people questions. And one of the things I always say to people is write on the back of a photo.
Mm.
All those boxes of photos you've got in your cupboards and drawers and so on, get them out.
Yeah.
And write who the people are, because one day nobody will know and they will be the only likeness of that person, whoever that person was. It's a terrifying hobby, genealogy, because you're terribly aware that every second counts.
Yeah.
And this week alone, I've lost 3 cousins and I wanted to ask them so many more questions and now I never can. But at least I will write on the back of the photos.
As you discover about your grandparents and your great-grandparents, I can't remember, is it your grandfather or your mum's grandfather who also had another child?
Yes, it was Mummy's father. And I absolutely know she didn't know that. That would have been, but I think his wife knew. But not the children. My grandparents had 4 children. One died, was sort of dropped by a nurse carrying him, and he was killed, and that was their only son. their first child. And then there were three daughters, and one of the daughters was one of those kind of angel children. She was beautiful and clever with a sweet nature, and she won a scholarship to Goldsmiths College, the first one in the family to have a university entry. And she died in the First World War with meningitis. I think a bomb went nearby and it shocked her or something. I'm not quite sure of the medical details. But I think that terrible event, which would crush any family, crushed my grandfather because he loved this Doris, her name was. And I think that was what sent him into the arms of a neighbour, as it turned out. And I only found that out a couple of years ago with DNA.
Did you do one of those ancestry tests?
I did an ancestry test and sent it in. And the offspring of the grandson of that union also did an ancestry test, or one of the DNA companies, and found out that I was down as a cousin, which is a very close relationship.
Yeah.
So we got in touch and we found out it was because they lived close. And I looked at the date and it was about the time that Doris died. And I think that that must have been the reason, because I don't think he was ineffably charming. He was glorious. He was an adorable man and everybody loved him. But his wife had a kind of, my grandmother, whom I loved and who came to live with us till she died, she had a sour, pained expression very often. Mm. And I think it was because that must have been discovered. But I'm sure Mummy didn't know.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's so interesting, isn't it? It really helps you start to see all those people as people rather than just, you know, in associate, just tangential to you.
Well, that's the exciting thing when they become flawed and desperate souls, looking for comfort, looking for employment, and very often, in our Jewish case, just looking for safety.
Do you take after your mother's side of the family more than your father's?
I think I'm a mixture of both of my parents. My mother could sing brilliantly. My father was tone deaf. I am tone deaf. Daddy was well educated and had an interest and a joy in words, as do I. My mother did not. She was not a reader. She was a talker and a listener and a schemer, a planner. Whereas my father was like a child in the world, and she led him by the hand and guided him. He was not someone, he wasn't shrewd. Mm. I'm shrewd. Mummy was shrewd.
Would you say you're still quite childlike?
I've got childlike qualities, I know that. But it depends on my mood, because sometimes I can be, I don't know, very wise, but I can be thoughtful and slightly intellectually snobbish. Well, not even slightly, but very. And other times, just I skip with pleasure about something. So I think I do have childlike qualities. And I'm glad I do, because I think that's rather nice.
Did you learn the power of making people laugh when you were at school?
I probably had the performer's trait, or when I was born. I mean, Mummy was a performer. Daddy was absolutely not. I mean, I used to say to him, "Did you never want to go on the stage?" And he said, "What are you talking about? Good heavens, no, I can't think of anything more ghastly. I really would hate anything like that." And of course, I love it. You know, to me, it's meat and drink to stand on a stage. And as soon as I stand on a stage, all the worries and the anxieties and the pains disappear. And I just have that sense of communion with them, and they, I hope, with me, and I hope that long continues. I mean, every time I go on a stage, or just before, I think, God, will I still be able to link with them? But so far, I can. But I don't think, I mean, I think it's just, it wasn't a particular age. It was already developed at school, because I've got a photograph of my stand. Mummy used to teach me, you know. She'd say, "Now stand like this." And so she'd make me hold my hands in front of me, folded like that. And I was posing. So I posed, and I was in front of the camera. I think the photo's in the book that I've just published, and it's got me going. Yes. And it's just adorable and terribly self-conscious, but, you know, so I've always had that.
Was acting something you always wanted to do, or did it just happen?
I don't think that I ever actually thought that I would be an actress. I don't think that was in my mind until Cambridge. I always loved performing and entertaining, but to earn your living doing that, I don't think that was an ambition until university, and then I thought it was a possibility. But I don't honestly think I could have done anything else.
No, well, from this position, it's impossible to imagine you doing anything else. I interviewed the actor Sheila Hancock, she's probably 10 years older than you, isn't she?
Yes, she is, yes.
But she was talking about when she started out, you know, and wanting to be taken seriously as an actor, but ultimately just being always treated like she was too common. She didn't fit the mould of what the BBC or the RSC or, you know, whatever expected her to be, and always being cast as like the ditzy blonde, as she put it, for her. Did you have a similar experience of going in and not fitting the stereotypical mould?
I think I fitted the stereotypical mould of the fat neighbour.
You know, okay.
The person who was not the leading lady, but was a character. A sort of like, I don't know, Rita Webb or Margaret Rutherford at one time, although she was later recognised as being a very great actress. Mm. I've never been the ditzy blonde. No. I would have liked to have had a go as a ditzy blonde, but that was not going to happen.
No, you had a different... You were put in a different box.
A different box.
Do you feel like... What is there now? I mean, you're 82, you're insanely busy, but are there still things that you're like... I want to do this while I still can. I want to achieve that.
I do absolutely want to go on as long as I'm A, able, and B, wanted. I don't like ever turning down things, and I'm very pleased I'm still asked to do stuff. I don't know that I have specific burning desires to play one part or another. I would like to play more Shakespeare, and I'm terribly envious, not jealous, of Brenda Blethyn, who is a friend and whom I admire and enjoy enormously. But I would like to have a character like Vera that I could... I mean, she would be better educated than Vera, of course.
Yes. Brenda has absolutely made Vera her own, hasn't she?
And she's wonderful, because she's actually nothing like Vera as a person. It's just a brilliant evocation of a whole world. And I love it, and I watch it, but I just would have loved to have something like Miss Marple or some detective. I have played a detective a couple of times, and it was great fun. And I just would love something like that. But I doubt now that I would be able to work on the lines speedily enough. I mean, Brenda's in her 70s. But once you become 80, it's just a tougher thing to learn.
I reckon you'd pull it off for the right part.
Well, I think I would too. I'd make bloody sure I did. But I'm not at all discontented. I don't want to give the impression that I feel a sense of grievance of any kind. I don't. On the contrary, I feel enormous surprise that I've got to this age and that people are still interested. That I find amazing.
And how have you managed to pull off 54 years of marriage relationship?
I love my partner, and she loves me. And we have a vivid intellectual communion. I learn so much from her. She's an historian of Indonesian, a subject which few people know anything about, but she knows everything. I love her. So that's it, really. I just have gone on loving her and wanting to be with her.
Before I ask you the questions that I always ask at the end, I just want to ask you something from the very end of O Miriam. In your first book, you talked about coming out and coming out in the 60s and coming out to your parents and how you regretted it. And at the end of the second book, there's a really poignant moment, I think, where you said that if you hadn't, you couldn't have been me. Do you feel differently now about coming out to your parents?
I don't know that I do feel different about it. It's just that if you're not honest, if you are continually living a lie, it is damaging to your soul. And I wouldn't have liked to have had to do that. But in telling the truth, in coming out to my parents, and particularly Mummy, I damaged her. I hurt her. I caused her real pain. I took away from her the longing and the hope that she would have grandchildren, that she would be able to talk about me and the grandchildren to other people, that she would have a longer life through the progeny. And I took that away. And that I can continually regret. Maybe it was a sacrifice. I sacrificed her to my own happiness. And that is not an easy thing to admit to I'm not at all proud of it. I'm ashamed. But she was so utterly stricken when I told her. I can never recover from that. When you give somebody you love pain, that's a bad thing. And I regret that. But as Tevye the milkman said, on the other hand, I gave myself the pathway for an open life. I have now no secrets. It's a very powerful and satisfactory position to be in. But she was damaged. So I hurt the person I loved most at that time in order to achieve my own peace of mind. And that was ultimately selfish. So what I say to people who are gay or, on some kind of journey sexually, don't tell people if you think they can't cope with it, because some people can't.
But if you hadn't, that would have been a lot of life lived in the closet, wouldn't it? Or in a family closet, if not.
Well, it would have been awkward until she died, until my parents died, which in my father's case, he lived a very long time. He lived till he was 95, maybe 96, I can't quite remember. He was born in 1899 and he died in 1995.
So
it was
96. Yeah. That would have been a long time.
It would have been a bit long, a bit long to lie. But I did what I did and I have to live with the consequences of it. And I have benefited. But the knowledge, the guilt, I mean, look, I did something which I'm much more ashamed of in a way, which was I hit Mummy once. I have written about that, but not in my... I don't know if I said it in my books. I don't know.
I don't remember reading it.
I remember telling a newspaper. But Mummy was... towards the end of her life, she couldn't move or speak, really. She had aphasia. The only thing she could say was, "I can't afford a carriage," and "poof, I want." And it was just so aggravating, and she was not, she wouldn't listen to reasons. If I'd say, you know, "Move, I want to move you so I can open this store," and she wouldn't. And once I actually hit her, not incredibly hard, but it's scandalous. It's shocking. I did it. So that I'm ashamed of.
Was that frustration, exasperation?
Yes, I mean anybody who's been a carer will know that sometimes you want to hit the person or shake them or something. Well, I did it. I actually hit my mother.
Let me just quickly ask you the questions that I always ask at the end.
Oh, right. Okay. Thank you.
What is your emotional age?
I've no idea. How do you find out what your emotional age is?
I guess it's how old you feel. I've made a note here that your therapist told you were 5, but with a bit of work, you could be 12.
Yes.
I don't know whether that's true.
Yes, she did. Well, let's hope I'm 12.
Is there a book that you have absolutely loved that's made a massive impression on your life?
I would say, without thinking about it, Little Dorrit.
Oh, I thought you might say that. Dickens had a massive impact on your life, hasn't he?
Charles Dickens, for me, is the greatest writer who ever lived. My friend Sonia Fraser, who died nearly 10 years ago now, together we made a play and we toured it.
The Dickens Women.
Dickens Women. And... rather bravely, I include 2 Dickens characters in my book tour.
Oh, which 2?
I have Miss Havisham and Mrs. Gamp.
What advice would you give younger women?
Advice. I'm constantly asked for advice now, and I always feel terrified because it's such a responsibility. And it depends what they need, who they are, what is possible. I just always say, seize the day, carpe diem.
Who is an older woman who's inspired you, or an old woman who has inspired you in the past to live your life?
Well, my great hero is Eileen Atkins, Dame Eileen Atkins. The technique she has in acting, the truth of her characterizations, the wit that she employs in her daily life, she's incalculably marvellous.
Is she about your age?
Older? She's 89.
89.
And as fashionable and as sexy as anybody you could name.
How do some women pull that off?
It's just who she is. It's her character. That's how she does it. And she's written, by the way, a brilliant book. Which came out the same time as my book. And I made more money because I was lucky. But her book is just as good, if not better. And it's called Will She Do? So I strongly advise you to read it and then interview her?
I would love to interview her. Absolutely love to. What is your superpower?
My what?
Your superpower.
I don't know what that means. What is a superpower? I thought that was like China or something.
Yeah, don't say China. Okay, what are you just incredibly good at?
The truth.
That is spot on. That is spot on. And last one, how many fucks do you give?
How many fucks do I give?
Yes.
None now or less.
Yeah.
No. But do you mean in terms
I mean
of
how much
do I care?
Yes, I do mean how much do you care?
I care enormously. So thousands of fucks I care.
Thousands of fucks. Thank you, Miriam. I'm really honoured you fitted me into your insane schedule.
It was fun. Thank you very much, Sam.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you might also like my conversations with Sheila Hancock and Janie Godley. You'll find a link to them in the show notes. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like more of The Shift in your life, head over to theshiftwithsambaker.substack.com and sign up for weekly newsletters, podcast extras and more.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.